Just imagine, the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
The Fire and Water Network proudly presents
JLU Cast.
Hello and welcome to JLU Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, Cindy Franklin.
And I'm Chris Franklin, and we're back with Season 2, Episode 6, Double Date. This is a fan favorite episode of the series featuring the debut of one of the most popular couples in the DCAU, and in fact, the most popular couple among the Fire and Water Network Patreon supporters. But even more importantly, we have a special guest to discuss this episode. Joining us for the very first time, somehow, on JLU Cast is Fire and Water Network all-star and founder, producer and host of Oh Hot Move or Not, Give Me That Star Trek, FW Team Up, and more, Siskoid. Welcome to the Watchtower, Siskoid.
Thanks, guys.
I'm so sorry it took so long to get you here. I mean, I guess it was a transporter malfunction or something. I don't know.
It's kind of my fault, wasn't it? It's like, I want to talk about these episodes. They're all late era.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, everybody likes, I mean, let's face it, everybody likes the JLU episodes better than the Justice League episodes. I mean, you know, so it makes sense. But yeah, it's I think everybody, all the other founding fathers of the network have been on the show a couple times at least. So it's great to finally have you here.
And it's about dating, which is something I do not do, but I talk about it a lot on Ohotmu, right? It's all about dating, dateability, superhero dateability.
That's true, and you had a romance comic podcast.
Oh, that's right. It's been so long. I forgot about that one. But you're right. Yeah, it's all connected.
I really love that show, and you don't do it anymore. So
too much production. It was so hard to put together.
Oh, I know.
To do it well.
I know. Yeah. So, what is your history with the DC animated universe? Were you in on the ground floor with Batman the Animated Series, or where did you come in?
I was, but I don't think I was necessarily a loyal watcher of the show. You know, when it was on, I would watch it. I don't remember being like, okay, I gotta. I feel like it's Justice League that brought me back into it. Like, okay. I know I watched both Batman and Superman, but then did I miss episodes? You know, I have them on DVD, so obviously I've rewatched them. So I'm not sure anymore, but. I remember specifically when Justice League started, that was a show that was, I mean, it was like back to back with Samurai Jack, I believe, at the time. So that was like on a Sunday or a Saturday on the channels that we had. So I would, that was appointment television for me, basically for the first time.
Gotcha. So is that your, is what, what's your favorite series in the Timverse, the DCAU?
I think it is JLU. I mean, it's the one with all the cameos and all the different characters, and you know, it's more exciting for a DC fan, which obviously I am,
right?
But I mean, there's no denying that the, you know, Batman was a high quality show. It's probably still the best in terms of tone, and but I want to give a lot of love to the Superman show. That's the one that's kind of forgotten in these conversations often, but I felt like, wow, from the beginning, it was a little bit like the post-crisis Superman, when those early issues, when you were just like rediscovering the legend in a different light. It was like that. I felt like, okay, that origin with Brainiac being the computer of the planet. And that's a great recreation, you know, reboot of the Superman legend. And I felt like that show was very strong. And it obviously dovetailed into Justice League. You know, there's like some elements that have carried over through all these series. So it's hard to say which ones are necessarily the best. I think they're all quite good on their own terms, and because they had their own identities.
Yeah. And I, you know, that's, you make a great point about Superman. I that I hadn't really thought about, but yeah, it had that Byrne-esque feel, just like the excitement of how they were going to reinterpret the characters. And you can look at it as Justice League is, and Justice League Unlimited are more of a direct sequel to Superman than really Batman in a lot of ways. I mean, the themes and but Superman was also more of a universe building show than Batman was too. So, but it makes sense. But yeah, I'm glad you brought up Superman, because we haven't really talked much about it in a while. So do you have a favorite Justice League Unlimited character that pops out for you?
I think it's, I mean, Hawkgirl probably. you know, feels like the character that you don't expect from the original, you know, and when they decided on the original lineup, of course you're going to have Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, you know. Mm-hmm. But Hog Girl was sort of the, oh, you know, I wasn't expecting that character. And she turned out to have like a great arc, and she was always very interesting. And I mean, I'm a comic book reader from a certain era, so redheads.
Right. Yeah.
You know, fiery redheads. I always like the female characters who are very much in charge of their own destinies. And I felt like Hog Girl was kind of that character. Yeah, that's why I love She-Hulk. You know, characters like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. She's definitely a standout for us too. And I know Cindy's a big fan.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. And in terms of JLU, of course, there's a question, which I felt was a great reimagining of that character. And so here we are.
Yes, today. That's right. Perfect segue. So let's talk about Double Date. It originally aired June 4th, 2005, written by Gail Simone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Directed by Joaquin Dos Santos, with music by Michael McQuestion. In the cast, we had Amy Acker as the Huntress, Marina Baccarin as Black Canary, Ken Schreiner as Green Arrow, Jeffrey Combs as the Question, Carl Lumley as John Jones, Glenn Shaddix as Mandragora, Scott Patterson as Faraday, Joe Nipote as Tony, and Stephen Shirippa as Cecil.
The Huntress infiltrates the garden mansion of crime boss Stephen Mandragora. She sneaks into his bedroom, confronts him with his crimes, and fires multiple crossbow bolts into his bed, only to find a pile of pillows beneath the covers. She's then beamed to the watchtower by a very angry John Jones, who reminds her that he warned her to stay away from Mandragora. He revokes her Justice League membership and tells her to pack her things and leave the watchtower.
Before she goes, Huntress visits with the Question, who is currently obsessed with unraveling the mysteries around Cadmus. After some playful banter, Huntress offers to tell Question all she knows about Cadmus if he will help her uncover Mandragora's whereabouts. Meanwhile, fellow Leaguers Green Arrow and Black Canary are guarding Mandragora, who is in federal custody. Agent King Faraday tries to prep Mandragora to testify about some of his criminal associates before the grand jury, but he's more interested in eating oysters and making lecherous comments about Black Canary. After being provoked into assaulting the massive murderer, the heroes are sent outside to continue their surveillance.
They spot two cars approaching, one a police car, the other driven by Question and the Huntress. They attempt to stop the Huntress from getting anywhere near the house, but the Question attacks, beginning a prolonged battle. The police are actually men working for Mandragora, distracting Faraday and his agents long enough for him to escape. Green Arrow and Black Canary subdue Question and Huntress, but find their quarry gone. The Question tries to lead Arrow and Canary off on a wild goose chase with a planted clue, but Green Arrow is wise to him.
While driving, Question reveals he knows that Huntress knows nothing of Cadmus, and also why she wants to kill Mandragora. Helena Bertinelli was the daughter of mafioso Franco Bertinelli. Mandragora was once one of his top lieutenants, but one night he turned on his boss. He chased the Bertinellis to their home, where Franco hid Helena in a closet. She watched as Mandragora brutally murdered her parents with his bare hands.
Green Arrow and Black Canary follow Question's car on Canary's motorcycle, but when Question drives into a train tunnel, Green Arrow is forced to urgently request a B-mount. Canary's motorcycle is crushed by a train, and the transporter deposits Arrow and Canary into the harbor. Under the docks, Arrow and Canary overhear Question telling Huntress that he knows that a ship from Mandragora's home country is arriving in the harbor that night. The ship arrives and Mandragora and his men approach, but before Huntress can take her shot, Arrow and Canary confront him. A battle ensues, with the incredibly strong Mandragora throwing the Leaguers around like ragdolls. Even Black Canary's sonic scream can't take him down. He grabs Canary, but Huntress gets the drop on him.
A young boy runs from the arriving ship. This is Mandragora's son, Edgar, who was recently rescued from a kidnapping plot by a rival gang. Huntress has her prey in her sights, but looking at the frightened young boy embroiled in a mob lifestyle he never asked for, she pauses, and instead fires at the large pallet of girders hanging above Mandragora. They drop on him, knocking him unconscious, but leaving him alive.
Question reveals Mandragora only pretended to cooperate with authorities so that he could escape to meet that ship, and that he and his son could run off together. Huntress asks why he went to all of this trouble for her, and he admits it's because he likes her. She gives him a passionate kiss through his mouthless mask and pulls him away. Black Canary is slightly disgusted.
Okay. So this episode, as we said, is written by Gail Simone.
Woo, woo, woo!
Yeah. At the time, Simone was regularly writing Black Canary and the Huntress in the Birds of Prey comic series at DC. And I don't know. I know, Cindy, you and I read Birds of Prey.
Oh, yeah.
Well, did you read Birds of Prey at the time, Siskoid?
I was out of comics at the time.
Oh, that's right.
No, and I've wanted to read that run since then, but I have real problems with the art. It pulls me out.
Is it the Ed Beans?
Ed Beans, yeah. I just can't. The sort of pornish art style of the time. It's a real problem because Gail Simone is definitely one of my favorite comic book writers.
Oh, yeah.
And then she's matched with an artist that I cannot stand. So it's like, oh, will I eventually? I may eventually, you know, get into it and just like grit my teeth and somehow find my joy in it. But it's been an obstacle.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that because, I mean, BOP could stand for butt shots of porn when, you know, Ed Beans was drawing it. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, it was such a weird dichotomy to have that.
See, I really wish that we could have Ramona Freyden draw and Gail Simone write.
Oh, my God, that's perfect.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah.
No, but it really felt like we got, like, basically a feminist writer writing a feminist series.
Yes.
And then we're going to get an artist who I feel, I mean, the art drips with misogyny.
Uh-huh.
So,
it's like I can't. I'm off the top of my head. I know when Chuck Dixon was writing Birds of Prey, he had several different artists. But I mean, I thought Chuck Dixon's run was excellent on the book too.
Well, yeah,
it was a great transition from him to her. But yeah. And I really enjoyed her work, and I enjoyed all the comics she's written. But yeah, that art with it was just so weird. But, you know, just a little history. Gail Simone came to prominence in the early days of comic-related blogs with Women in Refrigerators, which took comic creators to task for inflicting trauma and death on female characters to further male character stories. That name came from the infamous scene in Green Lantern Volume 3, Number 54, where Kyle Rayner's girlfriend, Alex DeWitt, is murdered and her corpse is shoved into a refrigerator. I'm sure most of you guys knew that, but in case you didn't, that's what that's about, because you still hear about people being fridged. Uh-huh. And Women's in Refrigerators. So, and we can thank Gail Simone. She's the one that brought the spotlight on that and said, hey, this is bull. You know, so good on her. She began writing Simpson comics for Bongo and eventually began writing for Marvel on Deadpool and for DC with Birds of Prey in 2003. And, of course, she's had a great career in comics. She's written Wonder Woman. She's written Red Sonja. She's written a ton of comics.
Secret Six.
Yeah. Yes. I really enjoyed that series. Yeah. She's just, you know, she's one of the best of the modern comic writers. She originally wanted to include the other star of Birds of Prey, Barbara Gordon, into this episode, but the rights to Batgirl were tied up in the Bat embargo due to the production of the Batman animated series. At the time. Apparently, this is according to IMDb, so take this with a grain of salt, but this is what it says on there. Batgirl would have become injured, although I don't know how permanent those injuries were meant to be. And she would adopt the Oracle identity, working with Huntress and Black Canary to solve the case, and they would never meet her.
Okay.
I think that would have been interesting because during this Cadmus storyline, if you'd had Oracle be part of it,
mm-hmm.
she could have, like, been providing intel to, you know, maybe she would start working with the Question, mm-hmm. and it'd been kind of weird if she was working with the Question, but not with Batman, and
right.
I think it would have been interesting.
Unless the Question is just not in it, you know, it's like she's right. the Question.
That's true.
And it's, yeah.
That's true. That could have been that case too. Yeah, exactly.
The person in the chair.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And you get rid of Green Arrow and you get rid of the Question, and it really is a Birds of Prey spotlight.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Of course, by the time Batman Beyond, we know that Barbara was walking. She was not paralyzed.
Right.
So I'm assuming that either her injuries weren't as serious. Well, of course, they later retconned that, and I don't know what they did in the New 52, but she had been injured but was Batgirl again, so I didn't read all that, but I think Gail Simone actually wrote that series, but
they gave her like she's got like cybernetics or something, a spine implant or something.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, but we know in Batman Beyond that Barbara Gordon's not paralyzed, right. So they would have had to get out of that somehow. So So in the episode that we got, which is great, we start out with two goons, Tony and Cecil, guarding a mansion. They're talking about scones.
I'm like, oh my gosh.
How come your scones taste so much better than mine? You know, you got to use the orange zest. I told you, you know, it's just.
Do I have to give you the recipe again?
Yeah. It's just, I love that this show takes the time for little bits like that. Why should they? But they do.
Yeah,
and
but, you know.
It makes the story that much better.
Yeah.
Like, these guys have lives, you know, when they're not killing people, they're making scones.
Yeah.
You know? Then the Huntress is introduced in badass fashion, taking out these guys with ease. She even shoots a crossbow bolt into the barrel of Tony's gun.
Yes.
Which I thought was cool. She has a different design here than her background appearances in season one. This look is a direct lift of Jim Lee's redesign of the character for the Hush storyline in Batman. So what do we think of this? Sisko, what do you think about this look?
It's fine. I mean, it's a variation on the costume with a bigger cross motif to make her, you know, to pay homage to the fact that she was a Catholic and the mafia connection, obviously the Italian connection. So it's fine. I think it's graphically, it looks good. And it makes it maybe a little more, or a little less generic in a way that just a like a purple bathing suit would be.
Yeah.
Right.
You're from afar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of like the outfit she had in the comics right before this was like more utilitarian, but it was the outfit they actually made into the Total Justice action figures. That's like basically the dark purple bodysuit.
Yeah.
It's the full, I mean, they had different variations where she didn't have leggings, but this is like a full suit, but she's got the lighter purple, like running up her chest, and purple gloves, lighter purple gloves and boots. And I kind of liked, I thought that was like the most practical looking. It looked like more what she would wear given her character.
Yeah.
This is a little more, again, Ed Beans is a, you know, acolyte of Jim Lee, and although not as, Jim Lee was never as cheesecakey as Ed Beans, but, you know, they've kind of got that, ooh, let's make it, you know, let's make her as sexy as possible.
Yeah.
Let's give her a midriff. Let's show
her. Here's my boobs.
Yeah, let's show her thighs, you know, which, I mean, obviously the original Helena Wayne Huntress was showing quite a bit of skin, too. But, so, you know.
Yeah, but when you think of the, like, she's essentially a Batman character that's been divorced from that legend.
Yeah.
But, you know, Batman, the, that's why I don't particularly like it when Batman doesn't have the yellow oval, because I think like the yellow oval it creates a contrast with the bat. So when, and it, otherwise it's just darkness.
Right.
So when they see the bat outlined, criminals cower in fear. With Huntress has a similar MO. She needs, I mean, it depends on what is distracting, what the writer thinks is distracting the villains.
Yeah.
Is it, you know, is it the Black Canary style where showing just enough sexiness that the villains are, the male villains anyway, are distracted? Yeah. Or
not necessarily just the male villains.
Yeah. No, but underestimate here. The character. Yeah, you know. Yeah. But then like this, it's when they see the cross shining, you know, that's distracting. That's maybe if they know of the Huntress, that's scary.
Yeah.
You know, so it's also kind of this is a holy retribution. You know, you've done wrong and God is coming to punish you through the Huntress.
Mm.
So I think like a symbol, because you say, well, this character uses stealth. Why would she have a bright, you know, white cross on her costume? But it's that kind of diversion, you know, it's supposed to be a warning. So I hide it with the cape and then suddenly when you see the cross, that's it. I'm going to get a crossbow bolt in the neck.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe people were rethinking superhero costumes at the time because, you know, that's why Tim Drake had a Black Robin cape, but on the inside it was still yellow. So, you know, he could hide in the shadows, but when he jumped off a rooftop and you saw this, you know, bright yellow swath of cloth through the air, you're like, oh crap. And then, you know, then he's on top of you, you know.
Yeah. So obviously, yeah. I have a podcast where we talk about costumes a lot. So,
right.
I've had, you know, a lot of experience dissecting costumes because, like, just in this, I don't know if you've ever talked about this, but you know, the ground crew, or I say ground, but, you know, in the Watchtower, the just like the normals, the crew yeah. that they have on mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
I was looking at it. You see them in the background in this episode. And I was like, are they wearing the Wonder Twins colors?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Is that what that is? Is that what it's supposed to evoke? That they're wearing, you know, Zan, Jane, and Gleek?
Yeah.
Were the only Super Friends who had a uniform, you know, like, obviously custom, but they all had the same colors. They all had the same uniform. Is that supposed to evoke that? And I don't know if you've ever talked about it. I don't think so.
I don't think so. No.
Yeah. So I thought I'd mention it.
Yeah.
I think that crossed my mind before, but I never brought it up on air. So yeah, that is a good point. Was that an homage to the Wonder Twins? I mean, it very well could have been. I mean, that could have. I can see. I mean, we got the Wonder Twin homage in Ultimatum, you know, with the shape shifting twins. They've got this. They pretty much wearing the same kind of purple that the crew's wearing. So yeah, very possible. Yeah, I like that. So we mentioned. Speaking of which, when the Ohatmu squad gets to the H issue of Who's Who, I want to see what they think of the Helena Wayne Huntress costume because
that's going to be a hot.
Yeah, it's going to be a hot. I mean, she's. I mean that. I mean. I thought, you know, I liked the character, but even as a kid, I thought she was hot when I didn't even know what hot was. So, you know, I think that's
she like, gave you stirrings in your utility belt.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, just as a key to that show, first of all, if you're a female character, you have a higher chance of getting a hot than if you're not.
True.
Just a strain of feminism going on around the table. The other thing is that the Who's Who entries get more hots than Marvel Universe entries because the art is you know is so strong in Who's Who,
right?
Whereas Marvel has, you know, the Marvel Universe book is just like these figures that all seem to be on a house style and in a box,
right?
You know, so the just Who's Who has been getting more hots than knots as opposed to Marvel Universe.
Well, I guess before we move on, we should ask the question that everybody asks. And of course, obviously, there's two canonical versions of. I mean, there's an older Huntress that's the
Which one. Huntress?
Which Huntress? Right? Helena Wayne or Helena Bertinelli? Which one, Siskoid?
I am partial to the Bertinelli one. I think the Batman family is big enough that we don't need necessarily the Huntress. It's complicated anyway. You need the Earth 2. You need Catwoman to be the mom. You know, it's. It kind of screws with the. If you've got an Earth 2 and you've got Helena Wayne in there, cool in the gang. I don't have a problem with that. But I think the Bertinelli, I've always liked this concept. I think I had a role playing game player who used it, or maybe he was. I don't know. I was doing a riff on. There was a Vertigo series called Mob Fire, which was similar mm-hmm. to the Huntress idea, which is the mob character. Who is going to destroy the mob from the inside.
Okay.
And so she had these connections, but she was going to destroy her father's legacy, you know?
Right.
So I liked that whole thing. And that gave her something to play that didn't need Batman. It could take place in Gotham, but it didn't need Batman. She became her own character at that point. She had her own motivations, her own goals, divorced from, like, she's not just like a female Robin.
Right.
Type, you know, who's following in the footsteps of these heroes that we already know quite well. So I think I am partial to the Bertinelli Huntress for that reason.
What about you, Cindy?
I'm sorry, I like Helena Wayne better.
Do you?
That's legitimate.
I can't help it. I like that. I like the Earth 2 versions. I miss them. I wish we could have that because it's not a hard concept to get. You've got Earth 1, you've got Earth 2. These are your possibles, and I like Earth 2.
Yeah. Well,
and that's the one that's running around the JSA series right now, isn't it?
Right. There's like a new version of like the I'm a few issues behind on reading it, so I don't know how they explained it. But yeah, they're back to a Huntress that's somehow the daughter of Batman and Catwoman, and I'm not sure how it fits in any kind of continuity. I don't think continuity even matters at DC anymore.
I think she's from the future. So okay. I think she's in. Yeah, I don't remember either. But yeah, I think she's from the future because she. Yeah, like the current Dr. Fate is her teammate, like she's come back from the future because right. somebody's killed the JSA.
Right, right, right. That's right.
Including Dr. Fate. So Dr. Fate is now a junior member of the JSA in our timeline.
Yeah.
In our era. And so she's come back, and that's one person she knows. And the other people are, you know, so her friends, her JSA, were legacy heroes from this point because she hasn't been born yet.
Right, right, right. Yeah, yeah. That's...
Pulling a Phoenix. Pulling a Rachel.
Right, right, the Rachel Phoenix. Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah. I, of course, you know, I totally agree. I think in a lot of ways that the Helena Bertinelli concept is a very, very strong concept, and I think it was a great way to recreate the character without the Earth 2 trappings and in the post-crisis universe. But I will always, I'm Earth 2 Chris, right? So I'm gonna like the Helena Wayne. And I was a big fan of hers. I bought Wonder Woman's comic book just to read the Huntress. Sorry, Cindy.
Same.
I did. I mean, I, you know, it's like, oh, the demons with Wonder Woman, that's cool. But I'm really more interested in the, you know, the Huntress fighting the Joker, and then Robin shows up, you know. Of course, I'm a huge fan of Earthworm.
It was Earthworm in the comics that I had.
Oh, Earthworm. Yeah, he was good too. Yeah. And the blind main guy or whatever his name was and all that. Yeah, it was a great series. I've got that trade paperback, and it's I always have a soft spot for her. I think she's got a really cool design. And of course, Joe Staton designed both versions of the, he was a co-creator of both versions of these two Huntresses. So good on him. But yeah, so I guess we should move on to the story. Uh-huh. But now we've established.
And this is her first speaking appearance on the show, right?
Yes. Yes. She had been in the background before with a kind of, I mean, a similar design, but like a more simplified look. And I mean, she was definitely, I think, at that point, just designed to be a background character. So they may have shown her in this look previous to this. I'm not sure, but this is the first time she speaks, which is kind of interesting because they go from like no, where they go with the character so quickly is, I mean, she shows up and then is kicked out of the Justice League. But
yeah, I guess it's like you're on a trial basis. Interestingly, I mean, she's voiced by Amy Acker, and then Black Canary is Marina Baccarin. So they're casting from the Joss Whedon crew.
Yeah,
it seems. Yeah.
Back when we thought Joss Whedon was the huge proponent for feminist character, female characters, and before we knew, Joss Whedon was a less than savory character, I guess. So unfortunately, yeah. But I mean, they show how cool she is. You know, she sneaks in, she goes through a laser grid, and then she confronts Mandragora in his bed. She tells him she's changed since they met, but he hasn't. And she talks about how he built an empire on thievery and murder. Then she fires 10 or 12 crossbow bolts, which just happened to reload, which is kind of interesting.
She just
shoots him in cold blood. I mean, she thinks that she's killing this guy. And again, I know we've said this a million times, but this is a kid's cartoon. There are Justice League toys on the shelf. And she just straight up murdered somebody in cold blood, or thought she did.
Right. And the fact, I mean, she came to him in his sleep. I mean, she, you know, not only is he not awake for this big speech of hers, but,
He's defenseless.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she just, So
I think it gets worse from there. I mean, there are more adult moments beyond this point. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're not treating this with kid gloves at all.
Oh, no. This one has got a lot of, at this point, and we've said that, I think at least by this season, they have decided, okay, yeah, we're still selling toys, but the audience that we're attracting is older.
Yes.
And we're gonna target that audience more than we're gonna worry about the kids. So of course she removes the cover and sees she just killed a stack of pillows. Then she gets called into the principal's office over her earpiece by Jean.
Yep.
Huntress, so she's like, Jean, what? And she gets beamed through an unrequested transport to the watchtower, and Jean tells her that she has violated direct orders to stay away from Mandragora. She's crossed the line, and then we go into the break. But, you think she just tried to kill a guy asleep in his bed.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to mention one of my two criticisms about this episode at this point. It's just the pronunciation of Mandragora.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's what they're saying, you know, Mandragora. And I feel like that's so awkward because the word is Mandragora. You know, the accent seems to be on the wrong syllable. Mandragora. That's what they say.
That's what
Mandragora.
They say.
Mandragora. Mm-hmm. But it's Mandragora.
Right?
Yeah, it's Mandragora, but they say Mandragora, so they got the word gore, you know, on the accents on gore.
Yeah.
Sure, but I feel like that makes it just longer and more awkward. So it bugged me. Probably my Doctor Who background, because there's a serial called The Mask of Mandragora. The villain, the alien influence is the Mandragora helix. So I'm used to hearing Mandragora.
Okay.
So maybe the American pronunciation is Mandragora. It just bugged the hell out of me, and they kept saying it.
I honestly didn't know. I had to look up what it was. I wasn't familiar. I know what a mandrake is, and I know it's basically the same plant or a variation of that plant, but I had to look that up. I didn't know what it was. So I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce it in America. Do you?
I'm going with Mandragora because that was on the cartoon.
That's how he pronounces his name, and very often our names, you know, people's names are not pronounced as they are spelled.
Right.
So we have to accept that it's Mandragora. I mean, you know,
right.
I'm gonna say it all over the place during this episode.
Okay. So what doctor was in that story? I didn't know.
It's a fourth doctor, Sarah Jane episode, or a four-parter. You know, it takes place in the Renaissance, and there's this alien energy that is contacting an astrologer. Not an astronomer, but an astrologer, and causing some mayhem there.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so Tom Baker, gotcha. So Huntress is angry. Jean has been watching her, and then she is furious when she realizes that he tipped Mandragora to the attempted assassination and had him moved. And he says, for his protection and yours. If you don't catch that line, Jean's the one that has moved him to this
safe house
where Green Arrow and Black Canary are there. So I like that bit. But she thinks she's going to get some Justice League demerits. But Jean tells her that tonight was a test and she failed and she's out of the league. And she seems genuinely shocked by this. Did she think that the Justice League would be okay with her just going into some guy's bedroom and just killing him? I mean,
well, and I'm sorry, but I have a problem with the fact that her only consequences for attempted murder is, well, you lost your membership in the Cool Kids Club. You know?
Well, how do you deal with vigilantes in a superhero world?
Yeah.
Right? They obviously exist, and they don't get caught, and they don't face any kind of justice. It seems like it's righteous what they're doing, but also it depends on with who you're hanging out with. I think from her point of view, she was always this character. This was not going to be her first kill.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
I don't believe that's her first murder. So there's a blanket membership in the Justice League Unlimited. It is unlimited. Every superhero is a member until Jean says, no, you're not. You know? So she's always been doing this. She's been vetted at some point. I don't know. So she's in the league. She thinks, and she's on her own here. It's a personal mission. She has not been sent by the Justice League. Sometimes you do stuff with the league. Sometimes you do stuff on your own. You know, you have your own solo adventures. She's her own woman. Sometimes she works with the team, and the way the JLU seems to work is like, okay, there's a mission. We're going to need you, you know, schoolyard pick. Go off and do the thing. You know, you just happen to be on the satellite during the call or whatever.
Yeah.
So she's on her own. She's doing her own thing. This is a personal mission for her. She's going to avenge her father. And so she's not on Justice League time.
Yeah.
So for her, it's like, what, you know, how dare you interfere with my own personal projects? This was not a Justice League mission where I killed someone. This was a personal vendetta that I am enacting. And it's the league has nothing to do with this. So I think she's justified because of the way that she's been treated and other vigilantes have been treated. you know, by this team in the past. But I feel it's also part of that theme that you've been following for the past several episodes about, you know, how far can you go? How far can superheroes be allowed to go? And she's the one that's like, she's a special case where she crossed, we see her cross the line. There's just no consequence at that point. But it's kind of the same questions that Waller, et cetera, have been asking.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And I mean, jumping ahead, we get that exchange between Green Arrow and Black Canary, which we'll get back to, but you know, they, about the Justice League protecting somebody like Mandragora, you know, and it's definitely, you know, we're in this moral gray area, but you bring up a good point because it kind of goes back to that whole question that people have. Well, why do characters who refuse to kill in the Marvel Universe team up with the Punisher? Why do they put up with this guy? Why don't they make sure he's locked away? Why does Superman team up with Lobo? You know, things like that. You know, it's like these characters are, you know, homicidal. They kill, you know, and oftentimes they're completely unhinged. And they just, they're sometimes as bad as the villains they fight, and sometimes even worse as far as a body count goes, you know, whether the people they killed deserved it or not. You know, that's usually, you know, the common superhero has that kind of, no, you know, it's not our place to make that judgment, you know, that we believe in the legal system and all that. So, but, you know, like you said, I mean, the Huntress, you know, you make a good point. She probably has killed people before in her line of work. She's called the Huntress for a reason. She's not called the Capturess or something, you know. So it does make you, you know, it does make you wonder if, like, okay, they turned a blind eye to it before, but because she's, and maybe because she's, it's such a premeditated thing that she snuck into the guy's house, and because they warned her to stay away from him, that's why it's a problem now. They looked the other way before, but now he can't look the other way. Maybe that's what it is. What do you think, Cindy?
I'm sorry, but they should have done their homework before they allowed her into the league. It's the same thing about, you know, when you are offered an educator position, just for instance, part of my contract is I had to sign a morality clause. That means even in my personal life, there are certain standards of behavior that I cannot overstep.
No murder?
No murder, you know. I mean, like, for instance, I couldn't go and have a job at a gentleman's club. That would be out of the morality clause. Yeah. I would be fired for that, even though it's on my own time.
Yeah.
That would not be allowed.
Yeah.
And to me, when you are part of a larger organization, you're a representative of that organization, not just during your work hours, but during your off hours too. Like, for instance, when I'm out and about in public, I mean, here at home, I might have a mouth like a sailor, but if I'm out and about, you're not going to hear me say bad words in the middle of Walmart, no matter how frustrated I am, because one of my kids might hear me.
Right.
And that's not, you know, that's just not going to happen. And I'm, when I say one of my kids, I'm talking about one of my students.
Right.
To
right,
me, they look up to me as somebody that they, you know, they want to emulate, that they expect good behavior out of. And if I don't have that good behavior, that's letting them down.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Your own children cursing, that's no problem.
Well, yeah.
No, I absolutely agree, you know, with that. I'm taking Huntress's part and thinking maybe, like, from her perspective, I mean, this is not the most ethical of characters already.
Right.
From the beginning. So, I agree. It's a problem. What is she doing there? Why would you have somebody like her or like the vigilante?
Why was she even offered membership in the first place? To me, that is a failing of the league for inviting her into their clubhouse before. There should be proper vetting. If you're going to have somebody representative of your organization, they need to be able, if not in their actual personal hearts, follow your organization, then they need to do that in the public persona, in the public arena.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think it kind of goes back to, you know, has the Justice League compromised its morals You know, that's a big question this season. For the greater good, have they allied themselves with kind of, you know, these fringe characters like Huntress, like the Question? And we'll see that the Question is not above, you know, attempted murder when he thinks that the means justify the end later this season. That's another question. Plus, I mean, but honestly, going back, the original Seven Leaguers, they didn't vet them too well because, you know, the whole Hot Girl thing.
Yeah.
You know,
so. Yeah.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting, but yeah, like you said, Sigourney, she is legitimately surprised that he's asking for her, you know, to leave, and she even mentions that you know what he did. So Jean at least knows her backstory with Mandragora, which I find interesting. So I don't know if they have to go over their secret origin with the founding members and or what it is, but she knows. But she throws her ID card at him and says, "Fine, I hope you choke on it," which I like. And also noticed that their membership cards have the little shield on it, yeah, like the workers do, that looks like the original Justice League logo, which I thought was a nice touch. There is a good point, though. Why does Jean, like, you know, is he's just going to, like, just kind of sweep this under the rug that she just tried to kill somebody?
Yeah.
You know, he's not going to.
But they don't beam her out immediately.
No, they don't. And they don't send an HR person with her to pack her things. They let her walk around the watchtower.
Yeah.
Most jobs won't let you do that. And you're not a, you know, homicidal person with a crossbow, you know. So, yeah, it's kind of strange. We see San, Mr. Terrific, and Red Tornado talking while Jean is reaming her on the transporter pad, and then Starman and Stargirl walking down the hall as she enters
fun.
Quarters. So, yeah, it's fun. I think they're hinting at some of the JSA connections with the Huntress, which I like, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a Prince Gavin.
Yeah, it's Prince Starman. It's Prince Gavin. Possibly Prince Gavin with a little Will Payton. Because, you know, if you read Jack Knight's Starman book, but yeah, it's Prince Gavin's Starman. He's the Starman of the series. So, of course, she hears the Question doing a soliloquy to Cadmus directly across the hall from her. Their rooms are across the hall from each other, their quarters. So, she enters his room and she fires a crossbow at the wall in front of him. You know, she couldn't have just knocked. You know,
yeah.
She knows how to make an entrance, obviously. She obviously hasn't met him before, which is kind of interesting based on how this episode ends.
Right.
Because what'd she say, Cindy? It's better if you read it.
"You're the league's data guy, the conspiracy buff, right? Wildcat says you're a nut job."
And then he says, "Funny, he says the same thing about you."
He's right.
Yeah, that's what a pair, these two, which we'll get into that, but... So Question has an ominous poster on his wall with a hand reaching over the globe, and it says "Got fluoride" with a question mark.
Yeah, badly spelled.
Yeah, it is spelled wrong, isn't it? Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Then we get the their exchange, and it's one of the best in the series. I put part of it in the trailer for the latest trailer I did. I know we shouldn't pick apart every line of dialogue, but it's just so damn good. You know, I like the fact that, you know, he turns back and says, "Okay, bored now, goodbye." And he kind of waves at her, and she tells him he must be the ugliest guy of all time hiding his face like that. And he just says, "Go away."
Yeah.
He does not have any time for this. But he does get upset with her when she messes with his conspiracy board, complete with thread connections.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I had no idea the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomena.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
I really like that dialogue because, first of all, the whole Girl Scouts connection, whatever, reminded me there's a card game called... Illuminati New World Order. It's by Steve Jackson Games, who make GURPS. Anyway,
okay.
And it's basically you create a conspiracy board, you know, and so there are factions that you connect to other factions and then other things that can happen. And you try to make your conspiracy bigger, more powerful than the other players also on the table playing the cards. And the Girl Scouts are in there, you know. It's like they've got like these ridiculous things to put inside the conspiracy. So that reminded me of that. But also, anytime that the question talks about a question, there's often the ability to have a pun in there. So, you know, no one asks the question. In other words, if you'd asked me, I could have told you that this conspiracy was going on. So I like that kind of stuff. I think you can really feel Gail Simone throughout this episode, because one of her great strengths, I think, is the comedy, is the humor.
Uh-huh.
So when you get that double act at the beginning with Cecil and, you know, the goons discussing cooking.
Scones,
baking. And like this, and then the banter between Green Arrow and Black Canary as well. There's a lot of funny moments, and I think that's one of her strengths. So, yeah, this is a great scene.
Yeah, it definitely is. And you know, as the parents of a Girl Scout, I'm slightly offended by this. Not really, but it's it's funny. It's funny. Maybe that's what they're doing when they're out there camping. I don't know. But
I don't know. We have to ask Dani. You know, she might be sworn to secrecy.
That's right.
Well, yeah. They've been conditioning her for the day. They're sleeper agents. We don't realize.
Yeah, and like, I mean, she's been a Girl Scout since she was in kindergarten. So
one of these days, you're going to eat one of those cookies, and bam, the plan's going to go into action. So better watch. I love this version of the question.
Yes.
I like the question. I read like the Charlton stories.
Yeah,
I had reprints of those.
Oh, okay. Cool.
They had like modern comics on it.
Yeah.
So those are the ones I got, you know, those old Blue Beetles, and the question shows up in there. And then they had the question appear in the new Blue Beetle series when it was at DC. Mm-hmm. I was really happy to see them. But then I guess the question, the Dennis O'Neill series, right, like that series, the Dennis Cohen series,
mm-hmm.
that was comic book stores only, I think. So
yeah.
I missed out on it in the market where I was. So I've never really read those, or very little. So I don't know if Vic Sage eventually became this kind of conspiracy nut, or this is an invent. It felt like an invention of the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it?
I think I read some of the O'Neill Cowan. I didn't read it regularly either because of the comic shop thing. I picked up issues here and there. I think they took the character in the conspiracy direction here for the first time. I think it's seeped back into the comics since this, though. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think they recast him in this light. You know, and this was. You know, of course, this was after the X-Files, and he's kind of like, you know, a creepy
Mulder,
Fox yeah. Mulder, yeah. Which, yeah. you know, even the same kind of posters on his wall and things like that, you know. So, yeah, I think this definitely has the influence of like an X-Files type show. And, of course, now conspiracy theory is everywhere. But back then, you know, it wasn't quite as omnipresent as it is now. Yeah. But
And to make it a superpower. Think was the fun thing. Like I've used this in, I mentioned role-playing games before, you know, in this episode, but we did have the question in, I played like a RPG where we took the DC universe and we put it in the 28th century. And basically like before the Legion, but way after everything else. And we only had like legacy heroes or that was kind of the idea. And one player wanted to play the question. So we put the question in there, like a future version of the question, a legacy of the question.
Oh, cool.
And this guy had actual conspiracy theory powers where he could make connections where no one else could see them, and found a way to make that work.
Oh, cool.
And you had like the face was more of a scrambler, like he looked like he was bitmapped,
oh.
like digitized or pixelized, which was like the future idea of this. But I really dig this version of the character. And it's like, this is a good example of the DCAU reinventing something. And it's like, why did no one ever think of this before? And why aren't comics more like this?
Yeah.
That I was talking about with the Superman reinventions, you know?
Right, right. And I guess, you know, a little bit of Rorschach from the Watchmen, who the question was based on, kind of comes back into the character here.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly. Yeah. That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
And you get Jeffrey Combs, who is you know, makes everything better.
Oh, yeah. Just wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't love Jeffrey Combs? Yeah. It's kind of funny. It sounded like your role player weaponized apophenia, which I didn't know what apophenia was till this episode. But she asked a question, if he knows what it is, and he tells her it's a tendency to see connections where none exist. But you know, that he knows what it is, but he doesn't believe in it. He obviously he's seeing connections where they do exist. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't think he's got it.
Right. But,
of course she pops up on the desk and displays her exposed upper thighs and midriff when she proposes a deal. She'll tell him all she knows about Cadmus if he helps her find Mandragora. And she immediately starts calling him Q, which is, you know, very familiar, which I thought I liked. So the Huntress Question couple was first seen in the 2000 miniseries Batman Huntress Cry for Blood by Greg Rucka and Rick Burchett, which is a great series. The Huntress turned to the question after Batman finally kicked her out of the Batman family for good, at least at that time. So that was one of the times that Batman was really, if I remember right, she like, I think she, her and like Batman and Nightwing were scuffling over something and she shot Batman with a crossbow or something. And, you know, and so she ended up like basically going on the lam and like meeting up with the question who, you know, like taught her how to, you know, I don't want to do a disservice to that book, but I haven't read it in a long time, but it got into a lot of the metaphysical kind of Zen kind of thought that Denny O'Neil put into his, you know, question series with Dennis Cowan. And then of course they kind of became, I guess, you know, kind of a couple there, but I think they're much more of a outright couple here, in a lot of ways. So which we'll see. Then we transition to a suburban setting and find Mandragora eating oysters under federal custody. He's telling federal agent Faraday about someone who died at the hands of Tommy Monahan, who is
Hitman.
Yes, the lead character in the Hitman DC comic series by Garth Ennis and John McCrae. So that was a nice little a nice little nod to another very homicidal DC character. And the only good thing to come out of Bloodlines. So,
yep.
Sorry, Frank. I'm sure Frank's not listening to this, but anyway. Glenn Shaddix provides the deep, oily voice of Mandragora, and he's wonderfully despicable in this role. He is best known for working with Tim Burton as Otho in Beetlejuice and as the mayor in The Nightmare Before Christmas. He passed away in 2010. But, yeah, so you know his voice, and I mean, if you know Beetlejuice, you know Otho. You know, when Beetlejuice, like, changes his, you know, makes his clothes turn into, like, polyester and he runs out of the house screaming, you know. So, yeah, he's great. Agent King Faraday makes his first DCAU appearance here. He goes back to the late Golden Age, first appearing in Danger Trail number 1, July 1950, created by the same folks who gave us Black Canary, Robert Kaniger, and Carmine Infantino. So it's kind of cool that they're sharing a scene together here. Mm-hmm. Of course, his name is a pun on King for a Day. So, you know, as a kid, I think the first time King Faraday showed up, Len Wein used him in the, or was it, no, it was Marv Wolfman. Sorry, Marv Wolfman used him in the Lazarus Affair storyline in the Batman comics in the early 80s. So that's the first time I ran into him. He had a prominent role in Darwin Cook's The New Frontier and the animated film based on that. There he was voiced by Phil Morris, best known to us as Vandal Savage on Justice League, and in live action as Martian Manhunter on Smallville. So lots of cross connections here. Here, though, King Faraday is voiced by Scott Patterson, best known for Gilmore Girls and the Saw franchise, and we'll see more of him in season 3. So I know Gilmore Girls, I never watched a single episode of Gilmore Girls, but I know it is a thing. It is a huge thing, right?
Yeah, but I never watched it either.
I know. So I mean, we've never, but I mean, it is apparently like, you know, even now, today, people are rewatching that show like mad. So
it's for normies, which neither, none of us are.
Right. Yeah. Faraday is frustrated with Mandragora because he's supposed to testify to the grand jury in exchange for immunity, but he's not very forthcoming with details. And you kind of think somebody like Faraday might know he's being had, he's being played, but you kind of get maybe he's so frustrated with him, you kind of think maybe he's starting to think that.
Yeah.
Because he's like, you know, you're not telling me anything here. You know, you're just giving me, like, well, he may have killed this guy and then that guy may have died and all this. And he looks over at Black Canary and Green Arrow and says he's nervous because he has enemies, even Justice League enemies. So I'm guessing he's been made aware that the Huntress is after him.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
So they probably, you know, warned everyone about, you know, the Huntress coming in. Then the giant slime ball hits on Black Canary, saying he notices she can't keep her eyes off him and that once he's cleared of any criminal charges, he could put you in a cage and have you sing for me, which gets Green Arrow upset. You know, who can blame him? He makes your skin crawl.
He
is really, really good. And I mean, of course, his design, he's an albino, but he's huge. He's got weird. He's almost got like Killer Croc like jaws.
Yeah.
Cause his like jaws run back and his teeth are like, like he's almost got like a shark smile, which
I felt like the Mandragora of the comics was just like normal, normal mafioso. But here is he's like, I mean, here they just ported over everything about Tobias Whale.
Yes.
You know, it's Tobias Whale without Black Lightning attached.
Yes, yeah, he is definitely like that, the Black Lightning villain, Tobias Whale. Yeah, he's they just gave him a different name. And it might partially be because I know it's always kind of iffy with using Black Lightning because Tony Isabella has been very, he's quick to, and I don't blame him, but he's quick to, throw up, hey, you know, I should be getting paid for this. So I know they've had some legal issues using Black Lightning characters over the years, and hopefully they straighten all that out before they did a Black Lightning TV series, which they used to buy as well as the main villain, at least in season one of that show. So,
see, I kind of think I see Mandragora as kind of like the kingpin of the DCAU.
Yeah, he is. I mean, there's definitely some kingpin stuff there. I mean, his whole he's super powered, but they don't come out and say he's super powered, but he's clearly got to be a metahuman to survive what he survives and what he does in this episode, which with the Kingpin, it always gripes my rear end when he can like fight Spider-Man and he's not, doesn't have superpowers.
Right.
Spider-Man can lift 10 tons, people. Why couldn't he fight this guy?
Right.
You know, it doesn't make a lick of sense to me. In Into the Spider-Verse, clearly he's got superpowers. So I'm like, okay, I can take that because he's just taking way too much abuse and doing way too much, lifting too heavy things and things like that. But yeah, he's a combo of the Kingpin and Tobias Whale. But somehow they gave him the name of the guy that killed the Huntress's family. So it's just, he's a character blender, I guess you can say. He calls Green Arrow a little leprechaun and tells him to get another 4 plates of oysters. Then this is the part that gets me. He licks the plate and says he likes his oysters sweet and juicy.
As oh, my God.
Looking at Black Canary. That's really loaded. Thoughts?
Moving on.
I agree.
Okay, let's move on. Okay. Canary isn't sweating it, though. She tells Green Arrow to let him talk. He never knows what when he's eating his last meal, and he has a big cackle. Then we cut to the question, picking up the Huntress in his sweet Pontiac GTO, according to IMDb. And again, this could be wrong because it's IMDb. But someone there said it's a 1967 model. And 1967 is the year that the question debuted in Blue Beetle number 1 from Charlton.
Oh.
So, nice.
Bigger, yeah. Greater, better claim.
Yes, yes.
Better claim to the model.
Right.
See, I learned all about Pontiac GTOs in the J.R. Ward series. That's what one of the fighters does in the Black Dagger Brotherhood. It's all,
rebuilds GTOs.
He's got a GTO that's purple, and that's,
oh wow, okay, well this is like dark, it's like purpley dark.
I learned
blue.
All about the GTO and when it was built and where they came from and everything else reading this book. So
I had a friend in high school that had a GTO, and we actually rode into school in that sometimes. Man, that car was awesome. But anyway.
Yeah, I know nothing about cars.
I don't know much.
I think they're pretty.
Yeah, they're pretty. I admire that era of muscle cars a lot. But yeah. So Huntress is impressed, and she says,
oh, baby doll.
Yeah. He lets her drive.
I know.
Even though she doesn't know where they're going.
See, I'm sorry, but for a guy, or for anybody to let you drive their car, that's like tantamount to, will you marry me?
Yeah.
You know?
But I feel like there's really two approaches. We get two couples, very competent. They're going to play basically a chess game, one against the other in this, where you think one has it up on the other one, and then, they knew better, et cetera. But in terms of relationship dynamics, I think we get really two portraits here, because as we're going to see, Green Arrow is, Green Arrow is kind of macho, as he calls Black Canary pretty bird, and he's always trying to defend her or jump on her to make sure she doesn't get hurt. He's very protective. That's his role as a man.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the question and the Huntress, where he puts her in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
In a way that Green Arrow doesn't, and we're used to Oliver Queen and Dinah being a sort of mercurial, volatile relationship in the comics. And even here, you know, there's a lot more frustration between them sometimes. And so that's because Green Arrow is so macho, and then Black Canary is such a strong woman that she doesn't care for that. I mean that's my interpretation of their relationship through the years. But when you look at Huntress and the Question, something else is going on there, you know. So I like that there's a big contrast between these two couples, that they're not working in the same way.
Yeah, that's true. I will say though, I think this Green Arrow is probably the best version of Green Arrow, because he's a little less of a chauvinist. He's a little, you know, he's the best qualities of Green Arrow, and they've kind of toned down the
he's more acceptable for the 2000s.
Right. Yeah, exactly. and he does later say, you know, I'll sick Black Canary on you. And so far you've just seen her nice side. So he knows that Black Canary is the more powerful member of the two of them. Yeah. Even without her canary cry.
But his instincts are, his reflex is to be the man.
Yeah, it is. He jumps on her. Whatever,
yeah. You know,
he protects her at the end when she protects the kid. He protects her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We cut back to the house, and Green Arrow is asking for 5 minutes with Mandragora. It makes you wonder what he said while we were away.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he said anything more, because you see her eyes squint. The very last thing he tells her, and she squints, and you know that there's going to be violence. Yeah. He's saying, like, it's something like, how do you end up with Green Arrow anyways? You know, we're all the best men in the Justice League, the real men in the Justice League taken.
Yes.
And to me, that was an ambiguous reason for her to get angry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I get the joke. She tells Green Arrow, don't do it, you know, like, let it slip off your back. And then she gets caught up in it. So that's an obvious setup joke, right?
Right.
But the, I mean, like, it seems to be, the first level of it is, oh, did she get angry because she went and defended Green Arrow's honor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, he emasculated Green Arrow. He's got him in a servile position, get me some oysters, etc. And that's what got her, that she's going to defend Green Arrow now. I prefer, and that's why I called it ambiguous, is that there's more than one way to take it. I prefer to think of it as, look, buddy, I am not an I do not need a man, and I'm not an accessory to a man. And I didn't pick Green Arrow because I had to pick someone.
Mm.
I picked Green Arrow because that happened. But I wasn't out, and like, I didn't need a Justice Leaguer boyfriend.
Mm.
And that's what he's implying. And I feel like for a character like Black Canary, that's what got her.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Well, it's also one of those cases. I saw it as, you know what? You can say whatever you want about me, but if you come for somebody I love, I'm coming for you then.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that has happened. You know, I have a big mouth, and people have said stuff to me that I'm like, eh. But if that, the minute they would say something or even imply something about Chris, I come out like gangbusters. I'm going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I see what you're saying, but I kind of tend to agree with Cindy, because I think we're kind of that way with each other.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you can throw off on me, but don't you say anything about her. I'll.
Yeah. I mean, and Chris has done the same thing.
Whoop your ass.
Yeah. You know, say whatever about me, and okay, but you say something about him, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah. We do find out, though, that she hurt her hand hitting him.
Yes.
So this is where we kind of start to get the hint that
he's got something extra.
He's got something extra. Plus, she's like, there's no fat on that man, which is like, you know, the kingpin, because he's like, he looks like he's fat, but he's not. You know, he's solid and all that, you know. Green Arrow does call her Pretty Bird, as you pointed out. So that's a callback to the Satellite Era, what he always called her in the old comics. So, I do, though, I will say this, though. When they're having the discussion in the treehouse, you know, Black Canary is the one that says, you know, she doesn't really feel right about protecting this killer. And Ollie says, you know, it's not perfect, but if he rats out dozens of others, he goes free. That, you know, that's just the way it is. I think in the comics,
it would have been the other way.
It would have been reversed, because Ollie is the far left liberal who would have no time for this, where Dinah is the daughter of a cop or a private eye, depending on which Black Canary you're talking about. And she would have understood this better. This is how the system works.
Yeah.
So I think they could have actually reversed those. But I think they probably did it because Black Canary says makes you wonder how his victims would feel if they knew. Because I think they wanted to have some kind of understanding between her and the Huntress at some point.
Yeah.
Even though she might not know her backstory. You know, I don't know if Jean knows her backstory.
Yeah, but that's not his story to share.
So, yeah, but... then Ollie pulls her over for a makeout session in the treehouse. You know, it's very Robin and Marion of them to be in the treehouse and
yeah.
You know, so making out. So we get to see Cecil and Tony reused from the beginning. They're disguised as cops to distract Faraday. So I thought that was a nice touch. We know it's them before the characters do because you recognize the Tony's got the Rachel Ghoul stripes
salt and pepper,
salt and pepper hair going on there. Mandragora picks up Faraday by the head. It tosses him through the house, crashing it to the table. Man, this show loves showing big villains picking up heroes by the head nowadays.
Uh-huh.
Because Doomsday did that to Superman a few episodes.
Yep.
But well, there's a lot of throwing around because I think they're trying to avoid punching as much as possible.
Yes, that's true too. Yeah.
Like kids can punch each other and that's bad, but they can't throw each other. With that kind of violence.
Across the room, yeah.
But right. across the room or into crates or, you know, like, as it happens a couple times here, you know, there's a lot of more throwing in these cartoon shows than in comics where there's a lot of more punching.
Right, yeah, like even at the beginning, the Huntress, like, you know, here in a minute we see them, like, throw the Huntress and the Question into the car, you know, even though that would hurt worse than a punch. Because they literally could break their back because they're dinning the car, you know. But
and they're trying to punch or kick, but usually those don't connect.
Right, they dodge them. You know?
So yeah, they're playing with the how far they can go in terms of violence.
Right, yeah, but they could do the oyster thing. But anyway,
well, nobody know the kids don't notice that.
Right, that's true. I like that Huntress tries to fake she's on league business, but they say you know they already called Jean. But I'm assuming they were warned about her before.
Right.
They almost had to.
Like, if Huntress comes on the property, call for backup or, you know.
Right, it's got to stop her. And as Andrew would say, the Question goes all ham on Green Arrow, you know, punches him. And he says, why are you doing this, Question? Which points back to the fact that they worked together in Fearful Symmetry in season one at the beginning of the Cadmus storyline. And he says, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. And... I would say, yeah, Question doesn't think that Ollie would get it, but this is Ollie, and he pretty much followed Canary on an off-the-books mission just because he had the hots for Black Canary in the episode The Cat and the Canary.
Uh-huh.
And that also involved activities that could get a leaguer kicked off the team.
Yep.
So there's some nice, like, you know, how the couples kind of hooked up or in some way similar, you know.
The Question never... answers any questions. He's always asking questions or leaving it really ambiguous or like there's a question hanging in the air, like in that, like, you wouldn't believe me. In other words, the question just lingers. So that's just how he speaks. You know, he's never going to answer you cleanly.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. That's a good, I mean, that's another just good little subtle way of writing the character and Jeffrey Combs, the way he performs it, that just is just pitch perfect. And yeah, even if it wasn't the way it was in the comics, it's the way it should have been in the comics. So, I think it's funny, though, that Huntress thinks she's got the better of Black Canary. But she clearly was just holding back at first. And here I thought you were some kind of brilliant fighter. And then she stops her mid-kick and grabs her leg. And she's got this shocked look on her face. And Dinah throws her into that car door. You heard right.
And then flips her hair back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, physically they're outmatched. The new couple is outmatched by the, well, I say older couple. At this point, this is basically, you know, very new relationship as well.
Right. Yeah. They're not really they can start out being a physical match, but when they really pour it on, they're not going to beat these two, which I like. Of course, Mandragora escaped, but even he couldn't have predicted that the Question and Huntress would show up to keep Green Arrow and Black Canary busy like this, which, you know, so this worked out perfectly for him. And, you know, Canary asks Huntress if she knows what she's done, and she clearly, you know, she points out her perspective. She was hunting a murderer, and it was a murderer that the Justice League was protecting. And like I said, this isn't really part of the Cadmus arc. Of course, they mentioned Cadmus, but it does bring up those same questions about, you know, have the league compromised themselves, you know, in doing what they do, is, you know, have they crossed, you know, lines here that they shouldn't have? So I like the fact that this is kind of a standalone episode, but it still continues that same through story that's been through this season.
But by the same token, would the league even have been involved if a leaguer, the Huntress, wasn't hunting him? Would Green Arrow and Black Canary been pulled into that if she hadn't been hunting it, you know?
Probably not. That's a good point.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. I love that Green Arrow notices the question picking up something off the floor, but he hands over a key, which Canary realizes is for a storage place down by the train station. And then the Huntress punches him in the arm. That sounds familiar. She's miffed that the question would fold like this. Like, you're supposed to be this, like, mystery man, and then you, like, just, like, fold the minute somebody, you know, asks you something. And he says, well, the real clue is, that wasn't the clue, that's mine. So the real clue is this container ship arrival program.
Right.
Which he had. But Green Arrow knows he's being played, and him and Black Canary are waiting for him in the treehouse outside. And Ollie says, I know when I'm being conned. And her response is,
you're cute when you're being an insufferable smarty pants.
Yeah. This is Cindy and me.
Oh, my God, yes.
I mean, I can see this. This is, I mean, this version of them is basically us. I mean, yeah. You know, and I mean, I can be the overprotective guy type thing, too. I mean, I'll admit it. I'm a little old-fashioned that way. I can be this Green Arrow. I'm not going to be the comic book Green Arrow, but I can, their relationship, you know, kind of.
And you love being right. Oh my God, you love being right.
And you don't?
But that's not Cisco's what we're talking about.
Why am I on this episode? I'm going to leave now. So,
But you are cute when you're an insufferable smarty pants.
Thank you. Yeah. Then they're in the car, Question's car. Now Question's driving. He tells her that he knows she was lying about having intel on Cadmus. He asks her about Mandragora, but she says you wouldn't understand. Then he tells Huntress her old backstory.
Right.
So he just wanted to give her a chance to tell him.
Right.
But since she didn't, you know, we get this flashback. And she seems shocked that he knows this. So then we get the flashback and we see her family. We see her as a child with her mother and father and his goons, and the most frightening one clearly being Mandragora.
Right.
Franco looks exactly like Al Pacino.
Oh my gosh, yes.
He looks like Al Pacino as Tony Montana from Scarface. Now there's a movie no kid needs to watch.
No.
Yeah, I don't think we need to see, you know, him snorting up just mountains of cocaine off his, you know, desk and everything. So unfortunately, Franco doesn't have a little friend to say hello to Mandragora and his men when they come to kill the Bertinellis. Does that seem odd that he's unarmed?
He's so powerful, he doesn't need.
Well, that's
a statement in and of itself. He's so powerful, he doesn't need to carry.
And these were his weapons that have turned on him.
Exactly.
I get
that's
that.
That's his whole statement.
I get that.
And this is a really violent bit. And I felt because we don't see it, but he raises Mandragora, lifts up his fists, and he's gonna kill this guy with his fists.
Yes,
not a gun, and of course the shot is on Helena's eye.
Yeah,
behind the closet. So I mean, so it's all in our imagination, which makes it worse, obviously.
Yeah,
and it seems very brutal.
Yes.
So this is a piece of violence that on a kid's show, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's that, and I mean the mother too. I mean he's gonna kill.
What gets me and why would you not? I mean, I get that she loves her husband and everything else, but that's her child. She should have been with her child and protecting her child, not just, oh, I'm gonna be with my husband. Stupid idiot woman.
It's like, Lara, you get your ass in that rocket with Kal-El.
Exactly. I mean,
because the original Bertinelli origin, it's just like a hail of bullets, isn't it?
So yeah.
You hit everyone.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's this reminded me of when we saw the Flying Graysons murder in Robin's Reckoning in Batman the Animated Series, that you just saw the The shadows, the silhouettes, and then you saw them drop, and then you saw the trapeze swing back broken. You know, it reminded me a lot of that. But yeah, he kills them with his bare hands. I mean, think how awful. I mean, not that being killed in a hail of bullets is not awful, but the brutality of seeing someone beat your parents to death is just...
Yeah, it's not quick.
No, it's not. And it's... Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. Ugh.
And isn't it weird that the question tells this?
Yeah.
The thing. I like, of course, it means like his power is having information.
Right.
Yeah. He's probably got files on all the Justice Leaguers, and he's not using them for evil or anything. But he knows details of her, and he's imagining some of this. Right. I think it makes it worse because he's a creepy kind of guy.
Right.
So he tells it in a creepy way. So that's great for us because we get Jeffrey Combs narrating this horror story.
Yeah.
Right.
But some of the details, like because he says you were thinking this, you had this in mind, like, you know, you were afraid of this. He's imagining that this is true because there aren't any, you know, her psychology isn't on file in that way. But it increases his power in the story.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it does kind of, you know, but apparently, you know, he's got it note perfect because she doesn't, you know, say no, you got that wrong, or of course you're not going to do that, but you know, she gets teary eyed. You know, they show young Helena with a tear in her eye, and then they show the adult Helena with a tear in her eye. Although it does make it weird that I notice these things now, because like young Helena doesn't have white in her eye. It's just a pupil in like the shape of her eye. But then the adult Huntress does, and that's like, why didn't they make them look more the same? You know, why didn't they make their eyes look the same, so you know it's the same character? But their handling of eyes on this show, kind of, they can't decide what color eyes Bruce Wayne's supposed to have. So it's you know, she says, well, you know, if you knew that, why are you trying to help me? You know, and she says, you know what, you know what I'm going to do when I catch him. Mm-hmm. So why are you trying to help me? And he says, like you said, Cisco, he said, that is the question. So I like that statement. That's nice, because it's like, that's a good question, and that's me. I'm the question. So, you know, that's just...
Yeah. I think we're going to come back to his possible motivation at the end. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, we will. Yeah. We get to get the car chase. Canary tells question... Canary calls question on his lead earpiece, tells him to pull over, and I love what Huntress says.
Is that her? Give me that. You want a piece of me, Blondie? Bring it.
What do you think of that exchange, Cindy?
Oh, yeah. I don't need you to talk for me. Gimme.
Yeah, right. They've got this, you know, now they've got this personal, like, it's become personal because she whooped her ass, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, you know, she's this woman. Later on, she says, I'm really getting to dislike that woman, or whatever she says. Well, I'm starting to hate her, or whatever she says. So a question drives up a car carrier onto an elevated train into a tunnel. And I love Green Arrow's running commentary. This is so unnecessary.
Ramping off the truck. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a meta commentary on how there has to be so many action set pieces in each episode, with the characters kind of going out of their way to endanger themselves when they really don't have to.
Yeah.
You know, so this is like, this has become more than a car chase. Now we're going to go up on a train track. Really? We're going to jump this ramp onto this train track. And I love when they're going over the train tracks, and you can hear their voice vibrating. Are we dead yet? And she's like, no, repeatedly. And then he asks her again.
Look, if we die, I promise, I'll let you know.
Yeah, it's just... Gail Simone. She's so good.
Yeah. Although they missed the trick there, because... then I think there was a point where when she says oops, you know, when she sees the train coming after them,
yeah,
she goes oops, but I feel like the line should have been, okay, we're gonna die now.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And of course, the, you know, question and Huntress come up on the train, and she goes, train. He's like, I see it. Train, I see it. And then he turns, you know, so yeah. Nice dichotomy, you know. I remember when she notices the train. Okay, how are they going to get out of this? She's going to ride the train up on the side.
Right. That's what I thought was going to happen.
Yeah, no. But Green Arrow calls Jean for a transport, and he beams them out, but dumps them in the harbor.
Like, this is my other, I said I had two criticisms, this is my other one. Okay. Overuse of the transporter beam.
Okay. Right.
Like, when he beams, like, they beam Huntress out of the, you know, Mandragora's house, and then in this, at this point, they beam them out of the, of trouble, it's a Deus Ex Machina, but then they, it's like they, I don't know, they kept moving, and then were beamed or rematerialized at, outside the tunnel. In the harbor,
yeah.
How is that? How is Jean doing this?
Right.
You know, how are they tracking all the? I, of course, they've got the Justice League communicators or whatever, but it felt a little bit too Star Trek at that point for me.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like, okay, did they, if they beamed them into the watchtower, could they not beam them into the watchtower because they go flying across the room, and you know they'd be safer if they fell in a big body of water or. Did he just
I think that maybe, yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the intent. We kind of needed a line of dialogue to cover that.
Yeah, I mean, because he dumps, and I'm assuming he dumps them right outside of the train tunnel because that's where they were headed, and because they conveniently, you know, come up underneath Huntress and question later, it's so they can overhear what they're saying. And they didn't even know for sure where they were going because mm-hmm. they didn't know that he had the ship container program.
But so. The bigger question is, why doesn't Jean just beam up Helena while she's with the question and put her in holding?
Oh, well, she doesn't have he can't beam her up anymore.
While she's with the question.
Oh, well, yeah, she could. Yeah, because he could beam up the question. And yeah, that's a good point.
I mean,
yeah.
I would rather they found a way, like you said, like just ride the motorcycle, you know, around the train or, you know, like do a stunt.
Yeah.
It's almost like they ran out of, I mean, time and money, because a stunt would have cost, you know, would have been have to have an animatics and would have been more complicated. So it feels like maybe this was, we don't have the time to spare. So we need a quick fix. I just, you know,
yeah.
I imagine the original script had an actual sequence here.
Yeah.
And this was a compromise.
Yeah. And it also brings up, okay, anytime a leaguer's in trouble, they can just call Jean to just beam him out.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's kind of, you know, Star Trek usually, they would try to beam out of trouble sometimes, and there'd be one reason or another why they couldn't, you know. There's no real, I mean, they'd have to come up with, a you know, different reasons. And the transporters kind of before, well, we saw that in the Task Force X episode that the workers had to go to that cornfield to beam up.
It had to be a point.
So they didn't beam up from their house.
Mm-mm.
So why wouldn't, you know.
Right, and yeah. The original concept was that there was a tube in your home.
Right. Yeah.
So
or on
now
a rooftop,
it's just like
somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. So here they're just like beaming people in and out of anywhere. I don't know. That felt like a step too far. Overuse.
Yeah. Yeah. I know in the satellite era there were like transporter tubes on like a rooftop in Gotham that Batman would use. You know, like he would not go there to transport up. He didn't have one in the Batcave. He transported from there because I guess that way if you like used it, you know, somebody couldn't, like, transport from the satellite down into the Batcave.
Right.
You know, which makes sense. That's kind of what we were saying about the cornfield. So, like, it wouldn't risk the people's families if somebody,
right,
villain beamed down into, like, the homes of, you know, Justice League workers and started killing them or something, which, you know, makes sense. But, yeah, I've got questions. We're not going to get the answer, so I guess we should move on. But, yeah. Canary is really miffed that she lost her bike, which she rebuilt by hand. You're absolutely right. I'm sorry I saved our lives. And she swims off in anger, and he says, and Jean thinks the Huntress is the unstable one. I like at first that the question is being really cryptic, but then Huntress basically calls him out on it, and he says, okay, there's a freighter from Mandragora's home country coming in. And like we said, Green Arrow and Black Canary are conveniently under the docks listening. I find it funny that the guy in the bright green Robin Hood cosplay and the blonde in fishnets are better at stealth than the pulp trench coat guy and a female Batman.
Mm-hmm.
They're sneaking up on the sneaky people.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is kind of funny.
Yeah. I think the question knew.
You think he knew they were there?
Yeah. The question is in control throughout this episode.
Oh, that's
true.
He knows what's happening. He knows beforehand. He didn't even need that clue about the shipping containers, mm-hmm. The freighter. He already knew. He already knew who was on that ship, etc. But this is what I was talking about their relationship with him and the Huntress. he's letting her put the pieces together. Mm-hmm. This is her mission. This is her vendetta. This is personal to her. And he's letting her make all the calls.
Mm.
She's driving, even though he knows the destination.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow, nice. That's good. I like that. That's good.
I completely agree.
Yep. I like. I buy into it. I'll subscribe to your newsletter. No, thanks. So.
Cisco.blogspot.com.
There you go. Of course, they are going to attack Mandragore and his goons as after they show up there at the pier. But Green Arrow and Black Canary beat them to it. He tosses Diner around and shrugs off several of Ollie's taser arrows. Again, this guy's got to be metahuman.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way he's not. He picks up a huge steel girder. Again, metahuman. and make sure you pay attention to Chekhov's raised pallet of girders that are hanging from a chain.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to go off later. So, I do have to say the only sour note for me in this one really is Canary's line. You know, she leaps over him, and before she starts the Canary cry, she says, "Didn't anyone tell you, Mandragora? No one messes with the Justice League." I mean, it just seems a little corny from her because she has this big heroic moment that doesn't work. She doesn't win, and it also seems like something that maybe should come from one of the founders, but not a recruit. Did that seem kind of out of place?
It's kind of meh.
Yeah. What did you think, Siskoid?
Yeah, I don't know. It's fine for what it is. Had no thoughts.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
I felt like that the Canary scream is always, we've talked about this before on other shows, you know, it's like whenever there's a Canary scream, it's a weird finishing move. Like, why doesn't she use it like from the beginning if it's supposed to be so powerful?
Yeah.
And in this case, it rips off his shirt.
Yeah.
So I think it's a cool, that moment for me looked like something out of anime.
Yeah.
Especially with the white hair that he has and the anime tropes in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does. Yeah. I mean, the Canary cry, and actually her belt and the Canary cry is used in the opening of the show now. But I do like, though, you know, that the sound effect winds down like it's like almost like an engine, you know, like, you know, like put it, and then she collapses. I like that. That was kind of a cool effect. So
she's a recruit on the show, but for comic book fans, we know that Black Canary was an early member.
Yeah, or founder.
You know? And in some versions, a founder.
Right.
In the post-crisis, she was a founder. So
right.
For us, you know, it's like, not within the world, yeah, it may be, but for us it makes sense that she was at that time, wasn't she, like, was she chairperson in the comics? I think she was like
she
early
be.
2000s.
Yes, she was at one point. Yeah she definitely, yeah. And then if we get the you know, again, she's grabbed by her hair, picked up by her head again. Clearly, though, this is not a wig.
No.
Dinah, this is, she's bleached her hair blonde, or she's just blonde in the DC animated universe. So no blonde wig over brunette hair. But I have to say, I don't really like Black Canary getting manhandled like this, especially after he was such a lech to her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that. But we have to give the Huntress a heroic moment, a selfless moment to, like, try to save this person she's not real crazy about.
Right.
You know, it kind of, you know, it's like he tells her, you know, put her down, you know, and she's got the drop on him with the crossbow. And of course that saves Dinah. So she obviously doesn't hold too much of a grudge, you know, that she's not going to let him kill her, obviously. So I like that. He thinks he's off to federal prison again, but she's not having that. She's, you know, she's got him. This is the end for him. Then little Edgar runs out to his papa, and I can't help but wonder if Edgar isn't named after famous albino musician Edgar Winter of Frankenstein and Freeride fame. Because Edgar Winter is like one of the more famous albino people that, you know, celebrity. So I kind of figure that was a, you know,
that's okay.
not
I did not
possible.
Know that knowledge.
Possible.
So. Yeah. So
and in Edgar we do get the hint that Mandragora is metahuman, because little Edgar grows up to be on Batman Beyond, doesn't he?
Yes.
And he's got psychic powers. So it's a completely different power set, but I guess it runs in the family, the metagene anyway.
Right. He's one of the brain trusts on the Batman Beyond episode. Yes. So yeah.
And then in the Zeta Project, I guess, but I never watched that.
No, I never did either. I've never watched the Zeta Project.
I've never found it in the wild. So.
Yeah, I've one of these days I got to get around to watching that, but yeah. He says, Madrigal, of course, says his son was kidnapped by a rival gang on the last trip home, and it took him this long to arrange a rescue. And he says, rest assured, his captors were taught the error of their ways. Which Huntress replies,
rest assured, I'm about to teach you the same lesson.
Yeah, I thought that was like, yeah, that's nice. But I like the fact that, yeah, the kid's there, he's watching it, just like she watched her parents die. But the connection there is, these are two children, innocent children who were caught up in criminal families. Uh-huh. And I like the fact they don't beat you over the head with that, but it's there. You know, to Edgar, his dad's just this lovable papa that he runs out to. He doesn't know he's some, you know, monster, a murderer, a killing machine. And I mean, I'm sure Franco Bertinelli had just as much blood on his hands,
right,
as Mandragora. I like that. They don't get into it. You know, they just see the look she's looking in, you know, his eyes. She sees her own eyes as a child. But it's not just that it's a kid there. It's the fact that she is that kid.
Yeah.
You know, she's lived that life. And I think that's really nice. That's a nice touch. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he becomes a villain, so.
Yeah, that is bad. Yeah, that's true.
it didn't work. I mean, it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
But I do wonder about that. Like, to me, that was very ambiguous, a moment. You know, at the end when she says, like, well, I mean, I think I'm ahead of you there, because the question is going to come in and stop her from killing, right?
Yeah, yeah. He says, is this what you really want? Yeah, yeah.
And she says, and then she does the thing where she cuts the Chekhov's beams out of the, you know, just a crossbow bolt through a rope.
Yeah.
She's a very good marksman.
Yes. You know?
And then crashes on him. Of course, he survives that, which none of us would, but like we said, probably met a human.
Yeah.
And she says, no, that's not what I want at all. Not at all. And I felt like, okay, what does that line mean to you?
And to me, it means this isn't what she wants. She wants to kill him. She still wants to kill him, but she's not going to, because she doesn't want to be the monster that he is. She doesn't want to put that kid through what she went through. That's kind of what I took from it. What about you, Sydney?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But
yeah, it's got like a double meaning, you know?
Yeah.
So I know I don't want to kill him in front of his kid and create a monster like me, or have a child go through the same thing I did. But it also meant, yeah, I really want this guy dead.
Yeah, yeah. I'm disappointed that I can't kill this guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
You took this. Yeah, I just, that's not what I wanted at all. It's, yeah, yeah, but, yeah.
And this is the moment that we've been driving to, is the question was always going to do this.
Yes. Yes. He knew, like, everything.
You know when Green Arrow said, when he said, you wouldn't understand, like, you wouldn't believe me if I told you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, my mission, I am with Huntress to save her soul.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I like that. And, you know, and he also reveals why he's doing it, because... In a very awkward way, yeah, exactly. In a very awkward, maladjusted way, I love how he says, because I like you. You know, just like, this guy is like, you know, I mean, what do you think, Sisko? I mean,
I love that moment.
Yeah.
Because he hides his face. He's kind of embarrassed about it. He's shy.
Yeah.
And he hides his face. Dude,
literally,
your face is always hidden.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you don't want to, like, we would do this. A normal person would do this, not to betray the emotion, or, you know, you don't want the person to see you, I don't know, blush or whatever. That's not a possibility with him. Like, he's already hidden his face. He's already hiding his emotions. But I guess there's another reason why you wouldn't look at a person. It's like, you're afraid of the reaction.
Right.
What if they have a negative reaction to this and you don't want to see that?
Yeah, that's true.
It's cute.
Yeah, it is very cute. It's very endearing. And it's you know, as he's this hardened, you know, conspiracy theorist that trusts no one, but he's a little, he acts like a little love-struck little boy, you know, mm-hmm. which I think is funny. So... she grabs his tie.
I'm surprised he wasn't like moving his foot, going, "Oh,
yeah, yeah," you know? Like kicking his foot around, and it's like, yeah. "Oh, gosh."
Well,
yeah.
Well, they had a relationship that was kind of a innocent schoolyard. You know, like when she punches him. I know you guys do this all the time,
right?
But, as adults, but you know, when she punches him, it's a little bit like, you know, like young love, but kids.
Yeah.
They don't really know how to express it. And, you know, it's an intimate kind of action, but at the same time, it's, you know, so I feel like they're being played as children. Like this is a children's relationship, whereas Green Arrow and Black Canary maybe have a more complicated relationship, which is more adult.
Yeah.
So that's one of the contrasts here.
I feel like the Huntress is about to make it more adult, though. Based the fact that she pulls him to her with by his tie, you know, and that's kind of an implication of some, you know, little bit of kinkiness, and then she kisses him through that mask, which has to be like kissing Silly Putty. But, you know, maybe that's somebody's kink. I don't know. But
don't kink shame.
Yeah, I'm not kink shaming. He says, where are we going? Don't ask so many questions. If the GTO is rocking, don't come knocking.
That's golly.
Ew.
Exactly. That's what Black Canary says, too. I'm sorry, but ew. I love the way she says it, too.
Yeah, I don't even know, because of the relationship that she had with Huntress in this, I don't even know who she thinks is grossest, you know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's like oh, he could do better than her, she's crazy, or you know, and
or the opposite
other way around. Yeah, it's yeah, so
yeah, well, I mean, Wildcat said that both of these guys are nuts,
right?
So that may be an answer to how she got in the league. Did Wildcat, you know, vouch for her?
Maybe. He probably trained her.
They had a pre-existing relationship, and he didn't think this would ever come up.
Yeah.
Because this was a personal revenge. Like, Mandragora had to be in the country. She had to find him, etc. Maybe Wildcat just didn't know about this. He may have been the link between, like, the JSA guy who gets all the JSA-related characters into the league.
Yeah, well, and if I remember right, the Wildcat's the character that Helena came clean to first, that she was Batman's kid in the All-Star comics.
There
so,
you go.
So, yeah, they had a connection.
Well, and you also have Wildcat, who, you know, was in the fight ring and stuff like that. He might have actually said, hey, maybe I can save her. I'm being saved by the league. He sees her, you know, in
good
himself.
Point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, could be.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
I'll subscribe to your newsletter, too. I'm getting a lot of newsletters. So let's jump into our superlatives now.
Power action feature.
Power action feature. What did you think was like the coolest or best move, Siskoid?
That's a good question. It's a good question.
Yeah.
I love the way that they're portraying action, just like physical action on this show, ever since Cat in the Canary, I guess, is maybe the, you know, when that JLU episode that started that season.
Yeah.
Just the way the camera shudders, and it feels like it's in the fight with you and trying to avoid the blows itself.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, when there's hits, it shakes.
Yeah.
So you're real. It's really immediate. I felt like when they started doing that, it's like, oh, this is a completely different show. Like now it's on. Now it feels visceral. And of course, that's one of the reasons I wanted to be on this particular episode, is like Black Canary is part of that one. And like for me, Black Canary is the one that's fighting with the camera.
Yeah.
And then that carries over through other fights. But I mean, they found a way to make the hand to hand with street level heroes feel as epic as the stuff with the superheroes and the superpowers and the giant threats.
Good point.
So I love that fight when, you know, when the heroes first meet and they fight, and some of the moves in there, like you know, like Huntress being upside down and doing like a I don't know the names of the moves,
yeah,
but you know, like
spinning
around.
Yeah,
she's spinning with like two kicks basically.
Yeah,
spinning, and then Black Canary catches the foot and throws her, and so all of this business to me, like that particular moment, that's the coolest move for me.
Okay, what about you, Cindy?
You go, and then I'll go.
Okay, I kind of feel like I agree with all that. The hero on hero fights are very well done, but I would give it to the Huntress for she chooses a humane approach and drops those girders on Mandragora. I mean, you kind of saw it coming, but at the same time, it's still kind of brutal, which I think fits her character, that she would go to this extreme to drop that on him. And, you know, because it could have still killed him. She probably didn't 100% know he would survive, but she had a pretty good idea he would. But it was still pretty spectacular. And the fact that, you know, Dinah had to jump on the kid, and then Ollie jumped on Dinah, like we said, mm-hmm. you know, showed how much of an impact it was. And, like, Question backs up. And so I thought it was a really nice set piece. What about you?
Okay. Mine's actually not a physical one.
Okay.
Yes, there's a lot of great fight scenes, but to me, the power action feature is when Green Arrow knew the real clue wasn't the key.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't think about Green Arrow being the smart one. You just don't.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, I was just like, oh, well, good for him.
I think he should be. I mean, he was Batman with a bow and arrow. That was the concept, right?
Yeah.
He was basically Batman. Yeah, a different kind of Batman when he was created. So it makes sense to me that he's a good detective.
Yeah.
But that is not what he's known for in this iteration.
No,
and to me, that's the reason I'm like, he's like, hey, he really knew what was going on, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the reason I say I'm going with a non-physical response.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, good point.
Rotating chairperson.
Okay, for rotating chairperson.
Oh, the question.
Yeah.
Of course. It has to be the question.
Yeah, same here. I picked the question.
I mean, it is Huntress's story.
Yeah.
But he's so cool.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And he drives the story. He knows how it's going to end up. He knows, you know.
He's, like you said, he's helping her through this to try to, you know, he's trying to help her see that, okay, you really don't want to kill this guy. You know, you need to, you know, I'm trying to help you here. And so he's, like you said, he's in control throughout this story. He knows everything that's going on. He knows about the kid on the ship. He knows where Mandragore is going to go. And he knows that ultimately, or he hopes ultimately, that she's going to pick the path that's not going to get her, have her become hunted herself by her former teammates. So, which I guess we didn't really bring up. I guess, you know, we'll touch on, the Huntress will reappear, obviously, in this show several times. Thankfully, voiced by Amy Acker again. But, you know, her league membership, I believe, I haven't went back and rewatched the episodes we're getting to, but I believe she is still a non-member as we move forward. She does not get her membership back.
No.
So,
Justice League Communicator.
So for Justice League Communicator, what do you guys have? What about you, Siskoid?
What was the definition of that again?
That was like your favorite line or exchange between
Right, okay.
Yeah.
One of the lines, one of the comedy lines that we didn't mention, I guess it's a comedy line, is when it's during the chase.
Yeah.
And she tells the question.
Lose them.
Like airline luggage.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's great. Like, yeah.
So I felt like, that was, you know, those quirky lines, again, Gil Simone.
Yeah, that's a great one. What about you?
The insufferable smarty pants, because I've actually told you that.
Yeah, that's my favorite one, too. I just love that.
I don't get it. Why aren't we on our way to the train station?
Because I know when I'm being conned.
You're cute when you're an insufferable smarty pants.
The Girl Scout exchange is great, though. I mean, I think a lot of people remember that, you know, and it gives him a chance to say, you know, few people think to ask the question. You know, it gives him to be like super cool. So, yeah.
And you mentioned one of the great ones, like more dramatic, which is like, I was going to teach you this same lesson. You know, it's like it creates that mirror that I quite enjoy as well.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
Comic connections.
So for comic connections, I know we talked about the Huntress's origin and her relationship with the Question from the Greg Rucka series. Plus, of course, the Birds of Prey connection between Black Canary and the Huntress, which in the comics, they were always a little... The Huntress was always the one kind of on the edge when she was in the book.
Uh-huh.
You know, they were kind of always trying to rein her in, and she might go off the rails, and, you know, Oracle would get upset with her and send Black Canary to, like, rein her in or something. You know, that type of thing was always going on. Of
course, again, I think my dream... that I want a dream comic, or at least a dream page, where... Gail Simone writes it. Ramona Fraiden draws it. I want this.
Okay.
Make it happen.
Well, Ramona Fraiden's been doing a lot of variant covers for DC.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. You know, Ramona Fraiden could possibly be available to do this, but she's 95 years old, DC. So please, if you're going to do something, do it now. You know, I'm not trying to be, you know, but she's 95 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about you, Siskoid? Anything we missed?
I think that's it. I mean, there are these tropes. that we recognize as far as the ironic ending. You know, it's like those kinds of things show up. But the only one I had noted was Cry for Blood, which seems to be part inspiration for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I need to go back and reread that. It's been a long time since I read that one, but that was good. That was a good era of Batman comics at that time. So,
electricity is evil.
Electricity is evil. I think it's more electricity is ineffective because Green Arrow hits Mandragora with several taser arrows and they just tick him off. He's like Mongo. Oh, don't shoot him. You'll just make him mad.
Yeah.
It's just like... So what are our final thoughts on this one, Siskoid?
I especially like, I mean, I think this is part of the adulting of the series, but it's also, I think, Gail Simone's writing on this. I mentioned very often like lines that I felt had two meanings. There was an ambiguity to what was going on. And that's, I think, what I most appreciated was the idea that things aren't spelled out, that we could come to different conclusions. All of us, about what was really happening, what was really in, like, the question never confirms that he knew all along. It's just, you kind of get it from the dialogue, but you could completely interpret it another way. You might not even see it, you know, after your first or second viewing. So a lot of these lines are like that, like, what's going on in their heads? How is, you know, what's really happening? And there's no character at any point that says, this is why this, you know, explains the plot. So I felt like this was a very adult episode in that sense, where it really invests the viewer in, well, asking questions and coming up with your own answers, because you're only getting questions in a way, which was thematic with one of the guest stars, you know.
Yeah, yeah, good point. What about you, Cindy?
Again, I mean, it is one of those questions. This was not a cartoon for young people, this right. one, this particular episode, at least.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah. So. I think this is, you know, it's definitely one of the most memorable of the series. I mean, it, again, like we did that Patreon poll, and the question in the Huntress is the top couple of our Patreon supporters, surprisingly. I mean, they left Hawk Girl and Green Lantern in the dust. Yeah, and I think Black Canary and Green Arrow were second, which, given their comic book history, was kind of surprising.
Yeah.
Of course, some people, like, you know, their relationship's not exactly the best in the comics, but, you know, Jeffrey Combs, he continues to kill it as a question. Amy Acker is great as the Huntress, too. She has, you know, very sexy delivery, but you can hear that bitterness, that damage in her voice at times. And she does come across as slightly unhinged, but still very likable, you know. Marina Backer and Ken Schreiner, they're pitch perfect, pun intended, as Green Arrow and Black Canary. And like we said, Glenn Shaddix as Mandragora, he makes your skin crawl.
Yeah.
But you are kind of touched by his affection toward his son, too. So it's like, even he has layers. He's not, you know, just this black and white character, no matter how despicable he is in other ways. This is, you know, another personal story like the last episode, but the scale's much smaller, but it's no less engaging. And I wish Gail Simone had written more episodes.
It's, oh, yeah,
it's
absolutely.
The only one she did.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately. And we should point out, if you want to know more about Helena Bertinelli, that version of the Huntress, you should check out the Right On Network, where our friends AJ and Laurel produce a Huntress podcast. I think they have over 90 episodes, so that's why we didn't do a Watchtower Files this time. Just go listen over there. You'll be glad you did. And from some more discussion on the original Huntress, the Helena Wayne version, look no further than the Batman Family podcast, where they're covering some Huntress solo stories. Paul Keen just interviewed her co-creator, Paul Levitz, which is a great episode. And Paul and Sean are going to be talking about the Huntress for the next several episodes, as she had a feature in Batman Family at the time. But Siskoid, we want to thank you for stopping by the Watchtower. I'm sorry it took so long. We'll definitely get you back, at least by next season. Tell folks where they can hear from you on our network and other places if you want to.
Well, I did mention siskoid.blogspot.com, which is, I'm still writing, you know, there's always a text every day on that site. I'm a blogger forever,
right,
even though it's a dying medium. As far as podcasting, I'm on the network every Tuesday. I've got a show coming out, like tomorrow, at the pace we're going, tomorrow is the big special on Ohadmu or Not. So we're looking back at issues 9 and 10 of Ohadmu and issues 1 and 2 of Who's Who, and looking at some costumes that came up after 1985, 1986. So the girls get to react to new fashions, 90s fashions.
Black Canary ought to be in there, right?
Black Canary is definitely in there, and yeah, cool. I had to choose because there's dozens of costumes.
Right.
So I narrowed it down to, you know, like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
But also, they're going to have their first look at the Blackhawks in superhero gear.
Oh, my so, God. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's stuff like that. And
Listener.
So that's coming up. And then next week, there's a new Who's Editing with Bass is my guest. We're doing like the Titans issue. Mm-hmm. So plenty of stuff coming out from my end of the things.
Nice.
As well as my Hamlet podcast, which is covering every Thursday until Cheers Cast comes back. So I'm there twice.
Right. Yeah, you're twice a week now. Yeah, you're really you're prolific, as always. Yeah. So
special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, visit patreon.com/FWPodcast.
Extra special thanks to Jorge Luis Castillo, Matt Ryan, Neil Whitney, Jeff Owens of the Classic Horrors Club Podcast, David Capoon, and Rocket Dan Johnson, who specifically support JLUcast. You guys have to get Mandragora some more oysters. Ugh. Yeah. Sorry. Next time we have another fan favorite episode with a special guest to discuss the one and only JLU appearance of one of comics' most famous heroes. Join us next time for Clash. See you then.
Bye.
JLUcast is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises worldwide and is a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders, and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue Mommy and Daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for JLUcast and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast. Please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to JLUcast.
I know there's a connection. Don't think I won't find it.
Maybe you're not looking in the right direction. You're the league's data guy, the conspiracy buff, right? Wildcat says you're a nut job.
Funny, he says the same thing about you.
He's right.
Okay, bored now, goodbye.
You must be the ugliest guy of all time, Question. Hiding your face like that.
Go away. Don't touch that.
Wow. I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.